And welcome to this very special edition of What's on Joe Mind. This is special edition number 7. And joining me as always is Chuck. Chuck, how are you? Feeling better?
I'm doing good, Gary.
Still a little hoarse. Well, it's better than being a pig. Mike, how you doing?
Not too bad. I can't help but think that a little horse it's kind of like Chuck's a pony tonight.
That follows suit with the rest of our Sunbow discussions, correct? And Justin, how are we?
I'm doing all right, besides having some microphone issues, but I think I'll be okay.
That's okay. We can forgive you. This will be an experience in audio tonight, but we're going to give it our best shot, and I will clean it up as best I can editing. But Justin, go ahead. Let's not waste any time. Introduce who our very special guest is tonight for this special edition.
All right. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest tonight. He's a true legend in the world of comics as I was growing up, and I've had some opportunities to spend some time with him outside of comics a little bit over the past 10 years. I'm happy to report he's a great man as well as a great creator and a great artist. I could spend 30 minutes probably reeling off accolade after accolade, but in all honesty, anyone listening to this podcast, this man really needs no introduction. On behalf of the What's on Joe Mind crew tonight, it's my greatest pleasure to invite one of the fathers of G.I. Joe, Real American Hero, Larry Hama, to the program. Welcome aboard, Larry.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. It's definitely a pleasure.
We greatly appreciate it. We know you're a busy guy, and you got convention season ramping up real soon, so we're real happy you can devote a little bit of your time to us tonight. That's fantastic. Basically, I know over the past several years you've been interviewed probably more times than you can count, and most of the questions probably focus on the classic era of G.I. Joe, so I wanted to talk a little bit about your work on the current IDW Real American Hero series.
Okay.
I noticed we had that first kind of 6-issue arc, which, focused on Cobra being a security force, and then there seemed to be a really kind of a drastic shift both in tone and in art style as a new artist, S.L. Gallant, came on the title, and things seemed to change to kind of a more classically themed kind of G.I. Joe. Was that a conscious decision on your part, or did it just kind of evolve that way, or was that something that you really decided to do and move forward with?
Well, it's always, a collaborative effort. When I start working with an artist that I haven't worked with before, I make it a point to find out what they like to draw. And, as I get to know their strengths and what they like and how they go about, doing the storytelling, I probably change the manner of my writing to accommodate that. It's because comics is primarily a visual form, and the storytelling has to be in the pictures. So I'm always trying to adapt to that rather than taking the attitude that the writing is important and the artist has to adapt to me. I think that's probably because I came to the business first as a guy who draws the stuff rather than a writer. And it took me more than 10 years drawing comics to be able to convince any editor to let me write anything, mainly because all of the editors are writers. And I guess somebody who does, all the stuff is sort of a threat to somebody who only does one aspect of it. But, until, comics became a lot more commercial and became this, it became a collaborative medium. A lot of the early stuff was all done by one person. So the same person wrote it and drew it, inked it, and sometimes even lettered it.
Wow.
So, the whole thing about splitting it up into, a writer, a penciler, an inker, it was all about having to make that monthly schedule. Now, did I wander completely off the question or what?
Oh, no, that was fantastic. That was pretty much what I was looking for. I do find it interesting that it sounds like, so you kind of looked to see what S.L. Gallant's specialties were and kind of conformed the writing style around that. Is that kind of what you did, or is...
Well, the thing is, what I really like Gallant's stuff, because it's very straightforward, very classical, and sort of reminded me a lot of Ron Wagner.
Yeah.
And I felt more inclined to do, the older school type storytelling. You know, the original artist on the RAH books, I had a major problem with because of a language issue.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, English wasn't his first language.
Gotcha.
So the way I write is I don't write scripts. I write plots. You know, what they used to call Marvel style as opposed to DC style. You know, at DC Comics, the style was to write full, what they call full scripts, which is more like a screenplay. So that the artist was given a script that contained all the dialogue, so he knew exactly what dialogue and what balloons and sound effects were in each panel, and they could design around that. Now, Marvel style was more about giving the artist more leeway to be creative and do experimental stuff. And I always preferred that way of working. So the way I write a story is I don't think of a story in terms of words. I think of the story as a progression of visual images, and I try to picture that sequence of images in my head, and then what I write is just a description of the pictures I see in my head. But you know, I'm very used to doing those descriptions in my own voice, in vernacular. So if somebody isn't a native speaker, they have a lot of difficulty in understanding what I'm trying to get across in my plot. So that was a major problem.
Okay.
You know, okay. It made me have to like try to write very clearly and very simply, and you know, use small words. Which I find
kind of like you were writing for our show.
Yeah, I find it a little difficult, and I find it inhibiting.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because I just like to let the ideas roll off the top of my head, and you know, because I'm not really a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, I never went to school to learn how to write. So I don't know all the basic rules. I don't put together a story in the same way that lots of people put together a story. You know, I've never written a single story any other way other than by writing it page by page. I mean, I write page one, and I have no idea what's going to happen on page two until I get to page two. And so in a 22-page story, basically the way I wrote all the original G.I. Joe materials, I would try to figure out, I would just try to get the Joes into some sort of pickle, some sort of situation, and then I figured I'd have 22 pages to get them out of it. And you know, because I write page by page, I try to end the scene at the end of a page. I don't like to have scenes, you know, one panel of a scene sort of hanging over onto the next page. That's how I pace the stuff naturally. But I figure that if I have no idea what happens on the next page or the third page, then there's a pretty good chance that the audience, the reader, won't see it either.
Mm-mm.
I mean, that's the main thing that bothers me about, you know, 90% of what I try to read in almost any medium is that, you know, by the time I get to the fifth page, I sort of know how I figured out what's going to happen. Because I think a lot of writers, they figure out the ending and work towards the ending.
Yeah.
Or they have an outline, so they know how everything is going to happen. So it's, you know, they've created the choreography, and they have to shoehorn the characters into that choreography. Whereas to me, the choreography is just choreography. I mean, I don't really care about that. I care about the characters. You know, I don't believe that most people really remember plots at all. Because I know I certainly don't. You know, and even the stuff that I like or have read multiple times, I've read all the Harry Potter books, and I can't tell you what a single plot is. other than like, Voldemort's the bad guy, you know.
Yeah, we got that.
Harry saves the world. You get that, you know, but like. You know, but the details of cousin so and so or whatever, or you know, Uncle Sirius, or you know, who can remember any of it? But what you do remember is that if somebody says like, "Well, write me a psychological profile of you know Hermione or you know or any of the characters," you know, you can, because that's the reason that you keep going back to that well, because you want to spend time with these people that you've come to like, you know, and that's where I've always tried to put the focus is on keeping the characters themselves as consistent as possible, because that's what everyone is coming back for. You know, people aren't subconsciously saying, "Well, that was a terrific plot. You know, I'm going to buy the next issue." you come back to the next issue because you like those characters, and you want to spend more time with those characters, and you like the interaction of the characters.
Yep.
And I think that's what really goes wrong with a lot of stuff is that in the movie industry, for instance, they parse potential scripts, by these weird sets of rules that are all about, oh, does it have three acts?
Mm-hmm.
Can you follow this character arc? Blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And it's all about plot, and it's not a single question about, do you like this guy? do you care what happens to this person?
It's all about explosions and robots.
Right, and I think that's carried over to comics too.
Yeah,
and it's a real shame.
But going back to the comic you get to write with IDW, I know is in a lot of cases for these characters that you had created back in the 80s and 90s, it had been a long time since you were able to write write for them and have an audience again. You got to have some fun with those the comic books that came with some of the toy packages, and those were a lot of fun. But was there anybody that you were just was any character from the G.I. Joe mythos that you didn't get to write to at all in the hiatus that you were just real happy to be able to write for again? Like who was the guy that you settled into like his character was an old shoe?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of those. There's a core group of characters that are not necessarily the from the first batch that sort of grew into being in my mind the core group, and I think of the team that way. The thing is, I really don't have I didn't have the back issues, my long box of the back issues really sort of available to myself. They were sort of up in a closet in storage for a long time. So until IDW started doing the trade paperbacks, the reprints, I really didn't have easy access to the whole run. And I rarely go back and reread my own stuff. So I just forget things. because of the nature of how it's done. It's, I don't set up a timeline and say, this is what happens in the next, year or 2 years or whatever, I just literally do it page by page, and then I sort of, and if I don't read that book for another 15 years, reread it for 15 years, it's sort of like goes out of my head because I've got so much other stuff to do.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I can't keep track of it. I mean, I do have a disc with all the entire run of the Marvel run, plus all special missions.
Nice.
And all the British ones and all the 3D ones and everything on one disc, but the interface is a little difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as handy as being able to just pull the actual comic off the shelf and read it. So right now I've only got, you know, the reprint. I've got the reprint books up to the latest one that IDW came out with. And that's really handy because I just don't have any of the other books anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just donated all my comics to the Fales Library at NYU simply because they asked for them.
Wow.
So, you know, that took up something like 14 long boxes.
It's amazing.
My wife would kill me if I had 14 long boxes.
It was like... Yeah, I mean, well, it's not like, you know, so it's, but there's lots of like triples, quintuples.
Sure, sure.
Mm.
And then, you know, so it's like 13 or 14 years of Joe and, you know, how many years of Special Missions, and 8 years of Wolverine, and you know, Avengers, and Batman, and Blaze, and, you know, all this other stuff, you know, Bucky O'Hare.
Yep.
You know, I just used to crank it out.
So, don't forget about Nth Man. You had to have Nth Man in there too, didn't you?
Yeah, Nth Man too. I mean, and you know, like, I doubt if that'll ever be, you know, reprinted or collected. So, you know, and I think I have one set, one complete set that's kind of battered.
You know, it's all right. You got to hold a little back.
I had at one point a complete set of the Marvel run of G.I. Joe that had been the office set that I kept at Marvel that was actually also my notes. You know, all my notes about the storyline or things about the characters were actually written in the margins of those actual comics in marker or Pentel. And they were kind of, you know, the books were ragged because they were constantly being used as reference. And, you know, they had like little yellow post-its on the pages to mark pages and things like that.
Yeah, but there's some collectors out there that would love to have those.
Well, I sold it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I sold the whole box about, I don't know, 10 years ago, or 11 years ago. Some collector in Brooklyn drove in with his wife at a camera and like documented me handing them over to him.
Bragging rights are important to establish in situations like that, Larry. that's a pretty neat item to have there.
Well, apparently even shows back then that the old adage still sticks, picks or it didn't happen. Larry, I know that you've said this. You've been to a number of conventions, and you kind of told the story on how the Joe came to be. And this summer, we got the movie Avengers coming out. And there seems to be, in the early on, before Joe became Joe, you were working on a concept called Fury Force. And, of course, Nick Fury is going to be in Avengers. Tell us, those that don't know about the correlation between Fury Force and later became G.I. Joe, what was Fury Force and how is it going to fit into the Marvel universe versus the Joe universe that you created after the fact?
Well, I was trying to work up like a modern military book for Marvel. So, I figured, well, okay, it's Nick Fury's son, you know, and it's Fury Force, and they were like a special operations, like a very secret special operations group that was headquartered at the underneath the Chaplain's Assistance School on Staten Island.
Imagine that.
Yeah, and I, you know, there was the thing about, you know, doing a comic about a special operations group is that, you know, you they're all going to be very similar. You know, you could, You know, there's a big guy with a machine gun, you know.
yeah.
You know, the silent killer, you know, the girl who's good with a knife, you know, stuff like that. And I had already developed this thing and, like, you know, did all these development sketches and things, and then it was sort of sitting on the shelf when the whole Hasbro thing happened. So I just, you know, pulled it off the shelf and sort of morphed it, you know, morphed those backstories and those characters into, you know, fitting with the figure designs that we had to work with.
So would a Fury Force would have been fighting Hydra, or would they be fighting superheroes, or it would just be purely conventional?
We never got that far. We figured it would be some sort of terrorist group like Hydra. You know, and that's how, you know, when Hasbro brought us the whole G.I. Joe package, there weren't any bad guys. And, you know, that's the first thing that came up at our first meeting. And Archie Goodwin was at that meeting, and we all said, like, well, there's no bad guys? I mean, what are the good guys going to do?
Like, right.
Just, you know, practice marching or something? So we said, well, yeah, they should be fighting somebody, you know, specific, you know, and Archie Goodwin, I think, said, well, yeah, it should be something like Hydra, you know. And he's the one, I think, who said, why don't you just call it Cobra?
It works. And, it's got some legs.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, we just took it from there.
With G.I. Joe Retaliation is obviously coming out this summer, and we know for the first film, for The Rise of Cobra, you were somewhat involved on set and had a little bit of a consulting role. Have you had any kind of similar role with the next film at all?
Not at all.
But it
also sounds like, you know, they're sticking closer to the comics on the second one than they did on the first one. So it sounds like a trade-off to me.
You're consulting without actually consulting. That's...
Well, you know, I think hopefully, you know, people learn a lesson from the mistakes they make on the first time around on anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think they made a few bad compromises on the first movie. You know, it's because they're always double thinking. You know, they're always thinking, oh, well, we have to explain this, or, oh, that aspect of the comic or the animation isn't going to fly as this, so we have to, like, juice it up. You know, we got to have these special suits to make it run faster or something. And, you know, do you really need that?
Larry Hama, not a fan.
the thing is, what I liked about the first movie was that I thought they were fairly true to the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Lord knows I've seen plenty of movies where, you know, the characters... The only similarity with the character from a comic is the name.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
And, you know, the main characters were fairly true to the original concepts. You know, I really liked the way, you know, Scarlet came off.
Mm-hmm.
So
I agree.
So who knows? You know, I don't like to judge those things until I see them.
Sure. Do you get a little bit giddy when you're watching TV, or I don't know if you even watch the Super Bowl, and you see a trailer for this come on, and you just kind of know that these are characters that you breathe some life into, and now they're coming to life on the movie screen? Does that do anything for you?
I don't know, because I haven't actually seen the trailer.
Oh, really?
No. I mean, I've got access to it. I just haven't actually sat down and watched it. Okay. I have a lot of trouble looking at my own stuff.
Oh, really?
Once I've done it, you know.
Okay.
You know, I'm not somebody that goes back and, you know, rereads my own stuff or watches it, or I feel a little uncomfortable or embarrassed, you know.
Huh.
It's, you know, I guess it's because I'm never quite happy with it. I think that if I ever am completely satisfied or happy with something I've just done, then that's time to hang it up. You know, I think it's better in a way to not be satisfied with it, that you're always trying to make it better. Because, you know, once you start thinking that your own stuff is better than sliced bread, you don't really have any incentive to make it any better.
Good point.
You know, it's I don't know if you're happier that way. I think there's lots of people that like just love their own stuff and they're, you know, happy as clams, you know. But I think there's a certain amount of delusion going on there that I can't quite be happy with. You know, it's not interesting to me unless I'm trying to tweak it better. I always figure I, no matter what it is, I think I could have done it better.
Okay.
I wanted to actually ask about the Bucky O'Hare cartoon, because that's how I got to know the character. I honestly thought it was a great show. Is there any plans now with, you know, the resurgence? You have a, you know, Transformers back on the air. You have G.I. Joe back on the air. Like, restructuring and bringing the Bucky O'Hare property back on the air as another cartoon?
Well, Neil has actually been working on stuff about that. Nice. He's been fiddling about with trying to put together a CGI animated Bucky for quite a while. It's one of those projects that keeps falling off the shelf. You know, I actually wrote a second graphic novel, and Michael Golden laid most of it out and actually penciled about, I don't know, 20 to 30% of it.
Wow.
Before that got put on the shelf. So, who knows? You know, that's always been my favorite project. You know, it's just, you know, what I really wanted to do right from the beginning was funny animals. when I got into the business, there was no market for funny animals, so I had to do whatever else, you know, I had to do what they could actually sell. So I had to tread water until I could get a chance to try to do funny animals again. Still, you know, I mean, my dream job was always to do Uncle Scrooge. You know, and I've said it before, but like to me, you know, G.I. Joe is just the junior woodchucks with guns.
I mean, it's got to be satisfying for you then. I always hear that, you know, they say that there were traditionally two comic books that were aimed at little, you know, that were aimed at kids that really wound up being for adults, and of course one was Uncle Scrooge, and the other one is always mentioned in the same breath is your run on G.I. Joe. It's got to be satisfying.
Well, yeah, you know, the thing is, it's very strange that, like, you know, the original run on G.I. Joe was really, it had to be written so that, you know, 10-year-old kids could get it, you know, but my thinking was that, you know, everybody else is thinking, well, you got to write down to this demographic, and I thought, well, that's really kind of stupid. I mean, I figured that any kid that like plugs down his own money to buy something to read for his own pleasure is probably smarter than the kid that never buys anything to read. You know, so why write down to a kid who's smarter to begin with? And, you know, and I wasn't trying to entertain that particular demographic. My, you know, I write the stuff to entertain myself. You know, I'm my audience. You know, the only rule was that, okay, but, you know, you got to make it so that it's okay for a 10-year-old to read. You know, you can't have, you know, heads being pulled off and entrails being, you know, twisted out,
yeah.
Stuff like that. Yeah. And it was, you know, it had to be comics code level stuff. But, you know, all comics at that time were. And, you know, comics were actually bought and read by kids in those days. It's no longer true.
Yeah, heck, we were part of it. It seems like comic books grew up with our generation. I always feel like we're ruining it for the kids who are coming after us.
Well, no, because you know these mediums are of their time. You know that there wasn't all this other stuff. There weren't the video games to buy. You know there weren't 182 channels on TV. It was a different time, you know, and you could buy a comic for a quarter.
Yep.
So and you know, for years there were things that were sort of kid capital, you know, that like a kid could buy something and that personal possession had value. You know, it was sort of like stocks. You could trade it in on something, you know. A stack of comics had intrinsic worth. You know, you could trade them for other comics or trade them for something else. Same thing with baseball cards. Baseball cards and comics were a 10-year-old boy's capital. And they were affordable. You know, when I was a kid, you could buy a pack of baseball cards for a nickel, and you got some unedible gum.
Cut your mouth wide open, it would.
Yeah, it's. I don't know anybody who ever chewed that gum.
it's like chewing on glass.
They're off chewing a card.
I do want to ask you a question about your work with IDW. Currently, that's my favorite comic title. Justin and I, every episode when we get a chance to review the IDW titles, A Real American Hero is often what comes up first, and sometimes the other title doesn't even come up hardly at all. We really like it. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, that of the other characters that you haven't got a chance to write for, such as a Helix or a Wraith, do they have a place in the Real American Hero universe currently that you're writing right now?
I don't even know who those guys are.
I would take that as a no.
Are those G.I. Joe characters?
Yes.
Yeah, Wraith was a guy that came up in the Devil's Due. Helix was a character that IDW was doing in their mainline title, who's kind of one of Snake Eyes' compatriots.
Well, you know, IDW doesn't send me any other books other than the ones I write.
Okay.
So I have no idea what's going on in any of the other books.
Okay.
But I've never been able to read any of the G.I. Joe stuff that I didn't do. And I've never seen any of the animation. Any of it. I based all the G.I. Joe characters on people I know. You know, that's the only way I could keep the characterizations consistent, is that, like, if it's based on, you know, an old friend of mine, that I know when the characterization is going off the rails. So somebody that is writing it that doesn't know these people, it doesn't seem right to me. So I have a really difficult time in reading that, looking at that. It's too personal a universe for me. For all I know, you know, they could be like really terrific stuff, but I can't really bring myself to look at it. And I have enough trouble looking at my own stuff.
As you said, yes.
Forgetting like Wraith and Helix for a minute, like, do you have any other kind of library of classic characters that you just kind of are waiting to use, or is it really is just kind of going page by page and just kind of seeing who fits best here and who fits best there, and just kind of had? I know in some comics you really are pretty specific with which characters you use. Like, there was an issue not too long ago where you had the Killer Whale, and you were very careful to include Shipwreck and Topside and some Deep Six, I think, some very, you know, water-based Joes. Do you have kind of a master list of characters that belong in certain environments? You just have to kind of leaf back through your old comics, and do you have a list of people that are kind of in the wings that you're waiting to use?
No, I don't really have a list per se. I mean, what I depend on a lot is, you know, Mark Palomo's
book. Because that's it's very handy for me because it's like it's all there in one volume. You know? I could see all the characters and all the vehicles, and all the stuff is right there.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's even a little piece of an accessory can can trigger something. Oh yeah, he's got that stupid thing. And that could springboard a whole story. Just the accessory. Or I thumb through the book and I'll say, oh yeah, the whale. I should use that.
Mm-hmm.
That triggers other stuff. I like to be able to have something I could like a thumb through like that, rather than sit there with a completely blank slate.
Sure. And along the same lines with the vehicles, I noticed one thing that S.O. Gallant does very well is really realistic translations of both classic vehicles and some new vehicles. Do you kind of lay out exactly which vehicles you want to appear in which issue, or do you kind of, I know you said mostly you do a plot, is that up to the artist to kind of pick and choose which vehicles to use and insert them on at their whim, or do you really dictate that?
No, I specify not just the vehicle, but which version of the vehicle.
Oh, excellent.
I recently did an issue about tanks.
Yep.
And I thought, wow, there's all these HISS variants.
Trying to get
all the variants in there. I think that would be really cool, so I pulled all the reference for the artist for that, and I said, look, this has to be, this variant, this one has to be that variant. And, the story is designed for that. There's like, one of the variants, raises all these hydraulics and can like go up high. And I said, well, we'll use that for this sequence, because that gives it a foothold in the way the readers could fantasize about these situations. Because especially now you're there's a lot of collectors that have a lot of these vehicles, and it's really cool to be able to see stuff that you've got and think is cool actually being utilized in a story. And that's where I'm coming from on that.
Well, it works. I get pretty excited when I see all those vehicles that I can look over and look on my shelf and see them on the shelf and then see them actually on the page too. It's pretty cool. So you're right on the money with that one.
Yeah, and I like to see them myself, so it works out.
This is a bit of a hypothetical question. Let's say G.I. Joe had, the toy line had failed for Hasbro in 82, and they decided, that's it, we're done, it didn't sell. Some of the characters you created that were exclusively in the comics, like Quinn, General Flag, Scarface, would you have tried to maybe incorporate them later on into another title or something, like make them part of the mainline Marvel universe?
I don't think so, because it crosses too many lines about trademarks and ownership, which are getting pretty complicated, just even in the last 2 weeks, with the whole Gary Friedrich thing going on. And the fact that whoever has the rights to do the comic, that whoever has the license only has the license for as long as that license is good for. And then, all the actual rights to that comic revert back to Hasbro, which is why IDW can reprint all the stuff that was originally done at Marvel. Because by having the license to do a G.I. Joe comic, they have the license to reprint all the old stuff, no matter who did it. You see? So that's what would complicate something like that. There's always an issue about with a licensed character that you don't own the character, you're just borrowing it.
Interesting. Yeah, and that would would ring true too, as Hasbro is. They've been kind of attempting to release. I don't know if you knew this or not, but they're trying to get a Quinn action figure finally made and released on shelves. And it's causing a little ruckus in the fandom right now because they've showed the figure, but they haven't found a way to get it released yet. So that ties right into that perfectly. I mean, obviously they own the trademark to that, and they're able to get a figure released for it. So
I thought there was a Quinn figure.
Well, there's an Arctic version, but they're finally doing the one in like his jungle fatigues and his shorts and his more traditional kind of jungle look.
I guess that's what the fans most remember, or they remember definitely last seeing Quinn looking like that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because he was only in the Arctic outfit for one issue.
Number exactly. Two, correct.
Yeah.
And then for the rest of the continuity, he was, you know, in shorts and knee socks.
Exactly. Yeah, making the shorts and knee socks version. Hopefully he'll get out sometime soon.
Yeah, so I haven't even heard about that. No, if you know,
we haven't heard much about it. That's kind of the problem there.
Yeah, as long as he comes with, you know, a machine gun and a weasel skull necklace. I think.
Yep.
Prerequisites, yes.
Larry, you spent a lot of time in the Marvel bullpen, and of course spent some time working in DC with Batman. Is there any of the big two characters that you ever wanted to do but never got the chance?
Oh boy. Well, I got to work with pretty much, you know, the whole span of characters. I mean, at Marvel, I worked, I did X characters and the Avengers and the Ghost Rider characters and Venom and Spider-Man and Man-Thing. I even did
Mike really likes the Man-Thing. I can't
I think I did one or two issues of Man Thing, and
awesome.
I did an issue of John Carter, Warlord of Mars.
Wow.
I really got to do a bunch of stuff. At DC, I edited Wonder Woman and Jonah Hex and Super Friends and Warlord and I think Mr. Miracle. So
that's about as across the board as you can go.
Yeah, I got to work on a pretty wide range of stuff. The main thing that I always wanted to do that I never got to do was Uncle Scrooge and the Junior Woodchucks.
So. I can't believe you won't give me a shot at that.
Well, actually, you know, a couple of times, you know, a new person would take over and whoever had the license or something, mm-hmm. He'd give me a call, and then we'd talk, and then they'd lose the license or something. You know, we'd go into limbo again, and then somebody else would call me, and I'd say, "Oh yeah, let's work something." And then it would always go off track. You know, who knows?
Because I know a lot of people praise your file cards because you seem to be able to take the essence of a character and really give them life in such a small little snippet of information, and that's something that I've really enjoyed about the file cards, and a lot of people have, the ones that you've done. It's been obvious that you haven't been working on them lately, but all the times you do that, you seem to be able to create a narrative pretty effectively in a pretty short kind of time.
Yeah, it's harder to do than most people think, you know. I mean, that's why they used to, like, you know, whenever, you know, the personnel would change At Hasbro, they would promptly fire me off the file cards. they think, well, why are we paying this guy to write these things when we've got guys right here in the office that are being paid a salary?
Yeah,
and they could knock them out right here.
Yeah,
and so they every couple of years, you know, there would be a turnover, and then they would decide to do that. And then they try to get them written in the office, and then a couple of weeks later, they'd call and say, "Well, you know, we'd like to. It's not working out." And then I would get a chance to say, "Oh, well, good, because like my rate just went up."
This is what we call capitalism.
Myself a raise, but you know, obviously they don't really care anymore about whether the cards make any sense or not. So. Yeah. You know, it's down to like, oh well, we could get them done for cheap in the office.
Yeah,
so let's do it. And
You know, people ask me, well, how can you tell the difference between the cards, you know, I wrote and the cards somebody else writes? And I said, well, it's because, you know, when they write them in the office, they just can't bring themselves to give the guy any faults. You know, it's always, oh, he's the very best at this, and he's the top this, and he's the world's fastest this, you know.
Yeah.
And I always found that totally boring. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, I think it's cooler to have a guy who's like really good at something, but he's afraid of the dark or something, or there's something
like Tripwire. He's a klutz.
Yeah, he's a klutz, or you know, he's got issues with socializing, or you know, he hates the cold, or you know, whatever, you know.
Yeah, one of my favorite characters has always been Hit and Run, which was a character that was released in 1988. It kind of surprised me in the file card. It was written that his parents were killed by a drunk driver, which seemed kind of extreme for a file card written for for a 10 to 12 year old. But it really resonated with me and kind of made that character a favorite of mine, even though he's barely appeared in any of the comics and hasn't appeared in any cartoons or anything. But so that kind of little detail really does make a big difference.
Yeah, and what I don't understand is that, like, you know, I wrote all this stuff down in memos to Hasbro.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they either just, you know, throw them away or they don't get it.
Yeah.
I had a map on my wall in my office of the United States, you know, that had, there was a population density map, you know, and I would, like, consult it when I was doing the file cards and say, well, where haven't I had a joke come from? You know, and I'd go, oh, okay, let's make them come from Duluth. and I would try to spread it around to the whole country, because that way, you know, everybody had something then to relate to.
Yeah.
You know? But, you know, one year, the guys at Hasbro figured out that I was naming, you know, giving file names to characters, you know, of people I knew. So they all said, well, why should he be allowed to do that? You know, we should, like, they give these guys file names of us, you know? So that's, you know, you got all these Hasbro employees, you know, being the file names of, you know, of all the Joes that year. And guess what? They were all from Providence. And I said, well, don't you get it? You know, they can't all be from Providence.
Smallest state in the country, and it's got the highest population density of the G.I. Joe team, yeah.
Right. That was so...
Johnny Shinagoa.
So silly.
A crack team of commandos was sent to procreate in Rhode Island. And then their offspring became Ninja Force.
And I actually made a whole list of these things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it away to them. I said, this is how you write the file cards. You know, they have it in black and white someplace, and they just ignored.
Well, it's ignored by, unfortunately, people who make the decisions in Providence. Ignored by them. The rest of us are latching onto it, and we love it. But.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like I was trying to keeping it a big secret. You know, I said, like, it's like, frankly, I didn't care. You know, I mean, you know, because, you know, they would fire me off of these things all the time. And, like, you know, so what? You know, I'll just do something else, you know?
Yep.
And, because I figure, you know, I don't have grudges about these things, you know? You know, life's too short.
Definitely.
Oh, and, but apparently other people do.
I know, and I promise I didn't butt in anymore, but in kind of tying in with your whole, the way you did the birthplace, I know that really... It made a big difference, again, you know, tying in with an old classic character, a character like Claymore, and I know you've spent a little bit of time in Vermont and kind of how Claymore was born in Manchester, Vermont, and went to Dartmouth College, and I, I grew up in Vermont, as you know, and went to high school in Hanover where Dartmouth College is. And so as a kid, you know, just those tiny little touches really immediately grasped me. And it boggles my mind that the big company doesn't seem to understand that. But.
Well, that's the same thing with me and Snow Job in Rutland. I mean, my mom and dad met a few miles away from Rutland. And obviously, they live in the town right down the road from you, Justin. So,
yeah.
You know, I remember getting Snow Job for the first time. Like, whoa, Rutland, Vermont. He possibly skied on the same slopes that my dad did when he was back in high school and stuff. So it definitely has a connection for me as well.
Yeah, you know, and again, you know, I wrote all this stuff down and I gave it to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, like, this is basically how to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I spelled it out, you know, I said, you know, it's, you know, there's two paragraphs, you know, and in one paragraph, you give his basic background and, you know, how he acquired his skill sets. And in the next paragraph, you know, you establish, you know, the quirks of his persona. And, you know, it's formulaic that way,
mm-hmm.
you know. But it always has to be personal. You know, you have to, there has to be something that a human being can identify with and understand.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the regional stuff is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, spreading, and I took great pains to, like, you know, spread out, you know, the ethnicities. You know, I said, well, give this guy, you know, a Polish name, give this guy an Italian name. Spread it out.
Yep.
You know, but, you know, that one year, you know, there were all these, like, Italian guys from Providence. Again, it's this massive, you know, about, like, you know, not getting it.
That,
you know,
infamous, like, Rhode Island Mafia.
It's like, you know, not getting it about the dreadnoughts, you know, refusing to believe that killing off Cobra Commander was a bad idea. I just couldn't get over that.
Yeah.
Hey, Larry, our podcast, we talk about Rollout Roll Call 3 quite a bit. We're the official podcast. We're definitely talk with Dave Tree a lot. We understand that you will be appearing at Rollout Roll Call 3 as your first UK appearance. Anything about that you'd like to talk about?
That's the thing in Southampton.
Correct, and I will be there too.
Oh, great! Yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to that. I haven't been to England in a while, and I've never been to Southampton. I've always wanted to go there, actually, because you know, I'm a big fan of, like, Napoleonic sea novels, you know, the Patrick O'Brien and all those. I've read them numerous times, and Southampton was the home port of the Royal Navy. I think the HMS Victory is still moored there. But, yeah, I'm really... That's only like a month away.
Right? Sure is, yeah. I'm definitely excited to go, and I'm looking forward to getting the chance just to say hi to you again.
Very cool. I know convention season is starting up pretty soon for you. I think once Rollout Roll Call 3 kicks off, it's kind of crazy from there on out for you, isn't it, Larry?
Yeah, Yeah, because I actually got invited to San Diego this year.
Oh, nice!
The first time I've ever been actually officially invited to San Diego.
Terrific.
Definitely going. You know, you have to understand, for the first 30 years of my career, I never got invited to a single convention. It's only within the past, you know, 3 or 4 years that I've started to get invited to conventions. I was never on the radar with, you know, the regular comic cons. I think, because, you know, right from the start, you know, because I worked on a toy book, I was sort of considered, you know, a pariah to the superhero fanboys,
yeah,
of the early 80s, who, fortunately for me, they're now over 60. And, you know, a whole other generation has come in. But, you know, working on a toy-based book was like the lowest of the low back then, as far as the fanboys were concerned.
Yep.
And, you know, and as far as the conventions were concerned. And even in, you know, in at the comic book companies themselves, they were that was the lowest rung, because the page rates were really low, because the licensing fee had to come off the top of the budget. So you could never afford to get A-list guys to work on a toy book or a licensed book. So it was always sort of like this weird, you know, backwater ghetto to be working in toy books. And like I said before, they always figured that a licensed book or toy book was only going to last 3 years.
Right.
And then, you know, when the third year started, everybody was trying to bail out. You know, they were totally willing to just bail out on G.I. Joe the third year, rather than get stuck with all this product in warehouses they couldn't get rid of.
Yeah.
And they took a chance. They said, well, we'll go to the fourth year. And then that's, I think, when they went beyond 4 years, they realized maybe something's a little different going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of fans would argue that the third year, they hadn't even hit their wheelhouse yet.
Yeah,
that's the thing, is that, like, you know, all business is based on actuarials. You know, it's based on how something performed before. You know, and in extrapolations of that, and that and the conservative, you know, safe way to go is to, you know, believe those charts. You know, everything else is very risky. You know, and you got to realize that in the end, you know, it's the bean counters, you know, vote that counts.
Yeah.
They do make most of the rules.
Right.
That is true. Yeah, and I remember a story, I don't know if it was Ron Rudad who told the story, but it was one of those old school Hasbro guys where it was at, I don't know if it was the Toy Fair in 85, but it was one of those, they had hit that 3 year cycle and they just decided to go for broke, and they unveiled the USS flag, and that was kind of where everything kind of catapulted and took off, and they took that huge risk, like you're saying, you know, so afraid to take risks, but they wheeled out a 7-foot aircraft carrier and took a risk, and it, you know, paid off in that case.
Well, you know, it's hard for most people to comprehend how big a risk that was. That was like nobody had ever done anything like the flag before. I mean, it was mind-boggling.
It still is. I don't think anybody's done anything like it since.
You know, I remember just, you know, I seeing that thing and going, my God, you know, it's like it's bigger than my living room.
Can mount the TV on there.
Yeah, it was, and I could, you know, but at the same time, I could understand, man, it's like, you know, every kid in the country is going to, like, want to kill for one of these.
Yep.
You know, it's got that, you know, that gimme factor, you know, built into it. And yeah, spades, you know. At that point, when I saw the flag, I sort of knew that things were different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That killing urge is why Chuck had to spend most of his youth in juvie.
Had to have that.
Don't talk about that, Mike. Don't talk about that.
Do you have anything you kind of want to plug at all, Larry?
All I can tell you is that issue 180 of G.I. Joe RAH will take place at the San Diego Comic Book Convention.
Oh,
nice. Nice. That's
cool.
It's going to be a strange tie-in.
Very cool. Very cool.
And I'm actually physically writing that at this moment. So.
Terrific.
Excellent. Looking,
but that's why I can't tell you how it ends.
Oh, he's only on page 3. They haven't even gotten on the plane yet.
Well, you know, that's the thing is, like, you know, I know it's the, you know, I had to, like, explain to IDW and Hasbro and San Diego people what's not going to happen.
Uh huh.
Like, well, no, terrorists aren't going to blow up the convention center. They're not going to, you know, machine gun the crowds or whatever. You know, I had to make up this whole list of stuff they weren't going to do.
Yeah.
But I really couldn't tell them what the plot is. I say, well, so these are the characters that are going to be there. This is where it's going to be, you know. You know, this is the proscenium, but here's the scenery. And here's the cast of characters, but you ain't getting no synopsis here.
Just want to take a few minutes and just thank you very much for coming on. I know you've got a busy schedule, and we really appreciate you sharing some of your time with us and answering some of our questions. I know I myself have looked up to you for a long time, and it's a great pleasure every time I get a chance to talk to you for a few minutes, and I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure was all ours, Larry. It's been a thrill.
Good night, guys.
So that is special edition number 7. Please check out our other special editions featuring the 2011 Canadian JoCon, Pursuit of Cobra Retrospective, SK Omega, JoCon Site Announcement, and FAQ, and then also our most recent Retaliation Figure Preview. So for our showrunner Chuck, our co-hosts Mike and Justin, I'm Gary, saying to all of our men and women serving, God bless, Godspeed, and come home safe. Good night, folks, and thanks for listening to this very special interview with Larry Hama edition of What's on Joe Mine. Have a good night. See ya.
See ya.